Studio 360.
Bart Layton has had a successful career as a London-based producer of unscripted nonfiction shows for TV in the UK and the US. Documentary series like Locked Up Abroad, which ran on the National Geographic Channel.
I was now in the worst place in South America. If it means killing somebody, then that's the attitude that you have to have.
You know the form, true crime stories combining interviews with dramatic reenactments. Layton's debut as a feature-length documentary director a few years ago was a film called The Imposter, which was a more ambitious and aggressive hybrid of documentary and narrative filmmaking. It's a true story about a young French con artist who had posed as a boy who disappeared from Texas.
I bought product to color my hair totally blonde, took big sunglasses, I took a hat, I took a scarf, I took a glove. I thought that if she couldn't see me, then she wouldn't be able to see another brother.
Now, Bart Layton has found another fascinating real-life story set in Middle America for his new film. The movie is called American Animals.
I'm going to say this one time and one time only. You're either in or you're out.
How can I tell you if I'm in or I'm out without you telling me the first thing about what I might be in or out of?
This would be something dangerous and very f***ing exciting.
It's also about young criminals and the blur between various lines of fiction and reality. But it is not a documentary. Interspersed with the fictionalized version of the events, the actual real people the movie is based on appear as well. Sometimes they even interact with the actors who depict them. Bart Layton is here to talk about it. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So describe what American Animals is about.
The plot is about a group of young men from Lexington, Kentucky. One of them goes to a university, one of the oldest liberal arts colleges in the U.S., and discovers that his library has a special collections room. And in that room is the most valuable books on the planet, potentially. In particular, The Birds of America by John James Audubon, which I think to this date is still valued in the tens of millions. And they begin to wonder if they could plan the perfect robbery.
Yeah.
And what starts as a sort of fantasy, as a kind of game, they arrive at a place where they kind of realize that actually they could probably do it and they could probably get away with it. And like all good heist movies, it doesn't go entirely to plan.
When you heard about this story, what made it a good subject for a Bart Layton film?
You know, I thought it was a fun story to begin with. I thought it was amazing that a group of seemingly well-educated young men from good families and good homes would end up attempting something like this. That was intriguing. I didn't know what could have motivated them, given that it seemed so unlikely they could ever have thought they'd get away with it. I decided to make contact with them.
Yes.
It was the things that they wrote to me and that made me think, okay, this is a story that has to be told, because it wasn't just that they wanted the money and they imagined they were going to be kind of riding off into the sunset with bags of cash. They talked about this need to be special.
Right.
And, you know, as a dramatist, you pick up any screenplay book and the first thing it'll say is, you know, establish your character and establish his or her problem.
What do they want?
What do they want?
Yeah.
And in this case, you know, this guy's problem was that he didn't have a problem.
Yes.
And he sets out to kind of manufacture one. And that just seemed like such a extraordinary and kind of honest starting point. And it also felt like it spoke to something about not just this generation, but maybe a lot of them, you know, and this idea that we're all inhabiting a culture where we're told that we have to be special.
Right.
You know, most of us, as we enter adulthood, we sort of, you know, we realize that probably we're not going to be remarkable and we're going to be, you know, pretty ordinary like everyone else. And but I don't think that was ever quite as problematic as it is these days. You know, I don't think there was quite as much pressure on people, particularly young people, to be kind of noteworthy, you know, to leave a mark on the world.
Right. Were you thinking of it at first as a documentary, or did you, out of the, as soon as you found out about it, thinking, no, I want to make a scripted feature out of this?
I kind of come from the place of thinking, you know, what is the best way of telling this story? And with this movie, you get the real people and you get this really unusual experience, because I think you have an emotional connection because of the inclusion of the real people that, you know, you don't have in a lot of straight kind of narrative films.
Right. And so you get in touch with these guys. Do you then write the screenplay based on what they told you?
Yeah, exactly. That's how it went. And oftentimes, you know, two of them would remember the same incident in a quite a different way.
Indeed. I want to talk about one particular sequence in American Animals that is one of my favorites of among many. It's when Warren and Spencer are first discussing the heist.
I'm pretty sure he told me about it at Rich's party. I remember it being cold.
I think I told him about it in the car. Maybe November, it was cold.
They both remembered the same conversation happening differently, you know, happening in different locations. So as a dramatist, you know, you can either go, oh, well, I'll just choose the one that is either going to be most cinematic, or if you're a producer, the one that's going to be cheapest to shoot, or, right. You know what I mean? You kind of, but I actually thought there's something really kind of important in that idea of these sort of conflicting memories. And so what I decided to do was to shoot the same conversation happening in the two different locations.
And it is absolutely seamless. Here's a clip of the first part where the actors playing Warren and Spencer are smoking a joint in the car.
I still don't understand how a book could be worth $12 million.
It's like if Picasso had a bunch of his paintings in a book.
The purpose of the joint, in a way, is that they pass it between each other and they pass it between the locations. So yeah. Warren may pass it to Spencer in the car, and Spencer takes hold of it at the party.
More like a secure room with glass cases and stuff.
So it just helps this sort of seamless transition between one place and another.
The sequence ends with this sort of very meta moment. Spencer and Warren pull up to a convenience store.
So Spencer gets out of the car and we follow him as he goes into the convenience store, and the camera pans back to Warren, who's left sitting in the car. And when we pan back round to him, Warren, the actor, played by Evan Peters, is sitting in the car next to the real Warren. And the actor, Warren, asks the guy who he's playing in the movie.
So this is how you remember it?
Not exactly. But if this is how Spencer remembers it, and let's go with it.
I don't think I've ever seen that before, right? A real-life person.
I hope not, yeah.
Talking to the actor playing him.
I hope not. I mean, I love the idea that, you know, we are basically in a scene from Spencer's memory,
right,
in
right.
which Warren is saying, this is not how I remembered it. You know, so if it's how Spencer remembers it, then fine, let's just go with that version kind of thing.
It's a terrific film, and people should go see it. As I used to say, it's a candy mint and a breath mint. It's a great thrilling heist movie and this interesting postmodern meditation on reality and fiction. It's really good.
I've never heard a candy mint and a breath mint. I'll take that.
You can hear a longer version of that conversation on our podcast stream, which you ought to subscribe to wherever you get your podcasts.
Sirth is a candy mint. Sirth is a breath mint.
Stop. You're both right. New Sirth is two mints in one.